You heard me ask the young people, so now I ask you, what does it take to make you happy? That's a question that opens up all sorts of windows, doesn't it, to the mind and the heart and the soul. For instance, would you be happy if your team won the Super Bowl today? Probably more so if you're betting on it. And yes, I've been a sports fan my whole life, and I have thoroughly enjoyed when my teams won, but yet I had to admit when it was over, it left me still a part of me unsatisfied. Are you happy when your family gathers, maybe during the holidays, and those family members are reasonably healthy and doing well? Yes, I imagine it makes you happy. When your job's going well and you're accomplishing goals and there's a feeling you're doing some good, do you feel happy about that? I imagine. For me, as a pastor, when I see the church fulfilling its mission and doing its ministries, impacting lives, making a difference in the community, that makes me very happy, and I've been happy a lot here. All of us seek happiness. Sometimes it's just a gentle wish. At other times, it's an aggressive quest. There is a standard formula for happiness that is put before our children on a daily basis. Let's call it the American way to happiness. And it goes something like this. Do well in school, stay out of trouble, and gain entrance to a good graduate school or college or tech school or maybe go in the military, where you will study and work hard, and then you can form and enter a profession, have a career. If you're fortunate, choose a good mate or partner, preferably marry and settle down. Have children, but not too many, because you want to give them every advantage. Work hard, especially work hard, because hard work is the key to achievement. Live in a good, safe community with good schools, a good environment for your children. Purchase a home if you can. It's a good investment in the community and your future. Know and move freely with the best people in town. Make connections. Have good friends. And gather a modest fortune over your lifetime of work so you'll have some security in older age and retirement. The American way, in many ways, resembles an anthill to me, with ants hurrying and scurrying, having to do the things that lead to this formula for happiness. And though not everyone has found happiness, few question this American formula for success. And if you're not happy, then you just haven't followed the formula well enough or far enough. Come on, we all know this road we journey on together, don't we? But then it's Sunday morning. We come together and we sit here, and we hear these beatitudes from Jesus, a condensed version of the wisdom of Jesus. It represents the very heart of the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, I will first note that Jesus doesn't condemn the American formula for happiness. He doesn't say, don't get a good education or a good job or a nice house in a good neighborhood. There is some truth to what we're doing. But if we're searching for happiness, full happiness, Jesus comes forward with a different route, a different formula. And what Jesus lays out for us is some very unlikely rules if we want to be happy. Today I want to start a series of three sermons, because it's going to take a while, on the Sermon on the Mount, because I know at some level we all crave fulfillment and happiness. We want to be content. We want to have a fulfilled life. And we know that there's more to life than football or even family or our vocations. It is the witness of sacred traditions that we are first and foremost spiritual beings. And while there are a number of Beatitudes, and we could spend a considerable amount of time on each one, this morning I want to focus on the one about having your heart do what is right and good, what Jesus called hungering and thirsting for righteousness. We moderns are insulated from real hungering, aren't we, and thirsting. But Jesus spoke to another world. He spoke to people who were hungry and thirsty, literally. Most of the people who would have heard Jesus speak were at risk of real hunger and thirst. If the rains didn't come at just the right time and the crops didn't grow, you could run out of food. Even in the midst of historic droughts here in California, none of us really worries if we're going to have enough food to eat, at least not yet. And in Jesus' day, if folks were caught out in that desert without water, they could die. Our ancestors, whether they came as Native Americans originally or from various countries in the world, I think they would have a better understanding than we do of what Jesus is saying, because they came here on foot, horses, wagons. They knew food and water were basic to life, and without it they could die, and some of them did. So they were driven to make sure that they always had enough food and water. Now, it's from that basic physical need that Jesus is trying to take us in a different dimension. If we get hungry enough, then satisfying that desire for food becomes the obsession of our lives. If we're thirsty enough, finding something to drink is our obsession. So what Jesus, the master teacher, is doing is he's taking hunger and thirst as a figure of speech to represent what is our greatest desire. Since it's Super Bowl Sunday, in sports, and those of us who played sports, athletes who win games tend to be the ones who are driven to win. Often you will hear in post-game victory speeches, when asked, why did you win? And they will say, we just wanted it more than the others did. And all week, we have all heard how Kobe Bryant, yes, talented, but everybody said what they remembered the most about him was what? He outworked everybody else. The same language is used in business. You know, some people are driven to make it. They hunger, they thirst for success. Somebody like a Steve Jobs. But are they happy? There's a story of a young man who came to the Buddha one day seeking the true way of life, the path of liberation and deliverance from misery, what the Buddhists call contentment. Buddha led the young man down to the river, where the young man was invited to follow the Buddha out for a ways, and the man thought this was going to be some kind of purification ritual. So they walked out in the river for a distance, when suddenly the Buddha grabbed the young man, pushed his head under the water, and held him there for a very long time. Finally, in a last gasp, the poor fellow wrenched himself loose from the Buddha's grip, got his head above the water, and then quietly and calmly the Buddha asked him, when you thought you were drowning, what did you desire most? And the man said, air. And the Buddha replied, when you want liberation and enlightenment as much as you wanted that air, then you will get it. The American poet and songwriter Robert Louis Stevenson once wrote, too many humans suffer from the malady of not wanting. Deep within Jesus' soul was an intensity, a compulsion, a drive to right wrongs, heal what's broken, usher in what Jesus kept calling the reign of God, the reign of peace, love, and justice in our hearts and in the world. His drive was contagious, so much so he was willing to sacrifice his life for it. And others caught that spirit and became his followers, his disciples, which we still call ourselves to this day. And together, all of them went out to seek to make this a better world. This was their greatest desire. And all the other needs and desires of life were pushed to the side. Their mission was more important than gathering fortune or seeking an easier life. Their personal ambitions were remade, recast, to do what they understood to be the will of God. In the Gospel of John, there's a story about the disciples finding Jesus one day without any food. So they offer him something to eat. However, Jesus refuses to eat. Instead, His answer gives some insight into the great desires of his life when he says, "My food is to obey the will of God, the one who sent me, and finish the work I was given to do." The Buddha read us right. Maybe you know his story. You've heard it. I've talked about it before. Siddhartha, Prince Siddhartha, born into a life of luxury and privilege, the son of a chieftain. At his birth, a wise old sage predicted he would either grow up to be a great king or a great spiritual leader. Wanting his son to be a king and not a religious leader, his father attempted to create the perfect life for his son, keeping him from seeing or experiencing any unhappiness in life. 4 palaces were built for Prince Siddhartha, one for each of the 4 seasons of the year, so he would not have to know extreme temperatures. A wall was built around their estate to keep out crime and poverty. He married the finest princess in the world. Every pleasure was his for the taking. Until one day, the young prince happened out past those walls where he encountered the 4 passing sights. First, he saw an elderly, aged person, and he realized for the first time he was going to grow old. Next, he saw a sick person, and he came to realize that we are all vulnerable to illness. And third, one day he saw a funeral procession and now knew that he was mortal and one day would die. And on that day, the Buddha would say, he lost his peace of mind. The one sight that gave Buddha hope was seeing a serene monk, someone seemingly at peace with it all. And thus began his quest to find his peace. Buddhism says that we humans are a nervous lot. We're anxious, we're restless, and so we suffer a lot. We long for completeness, though, and happiness, but we don't always have it, so we're discontent. What would it take to put us at ease? How can we be happy? Well, the good news of the gospel of Jesus is that our happiness comes from retooling our desires. We have to be changed from the inside out. You know, social pressure is powerful. It puts a lot of pressure on me to change what I wear, you know, how I live. But only the grace of God and my openness to it can change who I am. All of us can be more and do better. We can find enlightenment and happiness. But more than anything else, we just have to aim higher. When what we want more than anything else is to bring about that reign of love, not self-gratification, peace, not power, health, not wealth, then we're going to get close to the peace of Christ. Ralph Waldo Emerson gave the commencement address at Harvard College in 1844, and he told the class, "Be careful what you want, for surely you will get it." So what do you want more than anything else in life? To what great cause or movement do you spend yourself? There's a lot of ways to get there. Buddhism says there are 64,000 different paths. Some folks desire very little, and very little is often what they get. Others want plenty, but they want it for themselves and their team and their tribe and their party and their family and their friends. They feel deeply passionate, and they strive earnestly. But there's another way, a third route. Jesus called it the narrow road, and he said few follow it. And those who do don't always fit well within the world. Cynics will always say that spirit-driven people are foolish and idealistic. They're dreamers because they want fairness and basic decency for everybody. Yet such people are the sons and daughters of the prophets, of Buddha, of Jesus. They're the ones Jesus called the children of God. And so the question for us today is, are we one of them? And our answer will be determined by how genuinely happy we are. Amen.